Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy. He is Nick Osello. Nick, we got big shoes to fill. We called last week the best weekend of the season. We've got Masters Sunday. We've got tax filing day. We've got so much going on, and yet we don't have Larkin Kemp. T's and P's to Larkin as he's dealing with some family loss. But we've got a ton of awesome college lacrosse to talk about. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing fantastic, and the slates are getting better and better, but it's not the narratives heading into it. A lot of great games, and I am really bummed that potentially the best game of the weekend is the alma mater of one Larkin Kemp. Like, yeah. It's that type of season, and it's not every season that's like this, and it's certainly not every weekend that's like this, but there's going to be one or two games that are just on crack, and it turned out to be Brown-Dartmouth. That was not appointment television heading into the weekend, and if you're listening to this, catch at least the fourth quarter of it tonight, because in a slew of great games, it's just like that one stood out. It's just that type of season. And I love it. And I'm sitting in Boise, Idaho, and it's pissing rain and overcast, and it's terrible. So it's going to be a perfect afternoon to just put a dent in my couch and watch my Masters bets fail.
So it is not every year that Army-Navy does not lead this podcast when that is the flagship game of the weekend. We are going to get to Brown-Dartmouth, as you mentioned, as well as Harvard, Yale, Cornell, Duke, Cuse, Virginia, and do a quick sweep through the Big Ten. But we are not going to start with Notre Dame's 10-5 win over North Carolina only because I was there. We are not going to start with it only because it was number one versus number two. We're going to start with it because it's your birthday and you went to Notre Dame. Happy birthday, Nick.
Oh, thanks. Now that's the best gift. You just truly know how to make a man happy, Terry.
There you go.
And I appreciate it. And you were there.
I was there. The Golden Domer High School Lacrosse Classic. The second year they've done it, the brainchild of one Ryan Wellner, defensive coordinator. Last year it was around their Virginia game, and it was can't miss. They brought in the likes of Chaminade, St. Anthony's, Valor Christian, Upper Arlington, Loyola Academy, and a couple other teams that are escaping me right now. And so when it got announced for this year, I told Wellner once again, I was like, yeah, I'll be there. Little did I know that it was going to be punctuated by a number one versus number two matchup. But it was great to get out there on Friday. Got an opportunity to see Loyola from Los Angeles, Trip King, their kind of highlight player, junior attackman heading to North Carolina. They took care of business against Seton Hall Prep out in Jersey in the first game. And then the second game, really exciting one between another Jersey-California matchup. It was Del Barton who emerged 9-7 victors over St. Ignatius from San Francisco. A lot of drama in that one. And then we had a triple header on Saturday to get things going. And then the action ended on Sunday with Culver taking down Del Barton to presumably extend their stretch as the number one team in the Q Collar Inside Lacrosse Boys National High School rankings for one more week. But Culver turns around quickly and hosts Western Reserve, who's also undefeated, was at Notre Dame this weekend and stacked a pair of wins, including one over Sleazy A&M on Sunday. And then Hill Academy coming to town for Culver. So while the college lacrosse season is popping off, the high school lacrosse season is as well. And I am going to put together a rundown of evaluations and quick game recaps from those games, as well as the Homegrown Classic, which was the public high school triple header I attended 2 weeks ago. So check out InsideLacrosse.com for that this week. But Nick, it was funny because with all of this high school stuff, all these high school games kind of being my primary focus, it was one of those situations where it was almost like Notre Dame Carolina started before I had even really given full thought to the game itself, which is underserving a number one versus number two, but we also had what was going to be a number one versus number two before the Irish decided to lose to Virginia 2 weeks ago in Chicago last weekend when the Fighting Irish took care of Richmond. If you missed our conversation, make sure to check out last weekend's podcast. We went pretty deep into detail on that one. And I frame it that way because and we're going to get into more of this in a second, 90 seconds into the game, I was reminded of, oh yeah, these two teams hate each other. And I know that it goes back longer than Evan Connell's hit on Matt Kavanaugh, but for me, that's the seminal moment of the utter disdain between these two programs. Before we get going, can you speak on that?
I don't want to get the explicit tag on this, but it's funny in the pro locker rooms, you know, you kind of get to regale your college experience and, you know, you recognize that the people that I hated the most, Duke, Syracuse,
Denver,
Denver Mike Reese in particular, but now he's the funniest guy. In a lot of ways, you're like, oh, we just have more in common and we just were wearing different color uniforms. The UNC Notre Dame beef for me extends well past college, extended into the pros, extended towards, you know, if I see Evan Connell, it's on site. That's very easy to say on a podcast. And if he, you know, if you know him and you send him this clip, send him my number too. Don't get Garrett Epple going on that hit because he'll wind up in prison. It's funny, like these rivalries that you might not know. Oh, Notre Dame, Duke, Notre Dame, Denver. At least I'm only speaking on my behalf. You hate them, but it's like, hey, we can go grab a beer after the game. Outside of Nick Tinnell and who's another UNC guy that's not a scum? Can't think of any, but Nick Tinnell's great. This one is like the we hate each other and that hate will extend into the parking lot and we're not going to go get beers. And it's not this brotherly fun narrative. It's no, F you, like I'm sliding with the crown of the helmet. And I'm glad to see that this is still alive because this game was football in lacrosse pads and we're sliding high and late and we're going to try and kill you. And I remember I texted you at the beginning going like, yeah, refs are kind of playing it soft a little bit both ways. But they had to do that because if they didn't, that game would have gotten out of hand. The only other point I want to touch on quickly, I hope that the regional pride in playing other high schools is still alive. I love seeing the cross-state high school, especially the final scores. We weren't the best team, Wheat Ridge. We would never be invited to the Classic, A, because the program doesn't exist anymore. But we always went out to California for our spring break. And we would beat some bad team, you know, play La Costa close and then get our nuts kicked by Torrey Pines or Corona Del Mar. But anytime we would pick off one of those teams, we'd be like, we're putting Colorado on the map. So I hope that that is still like front of mind for these high schoolers. And we got to represent for our state or like these Californians are going to get their heads a little bit too big. So yeah. I just wanted to touch on that. And now we can jump into the actual nuts and bolts of Notre Dame UNC.
So it was a very rich game for, you know, what was ultimately a 5-goal final score spread and a game that only featured 15 goals. It was just so dense with a lot of different things. And I think that we can hit on a handful of these things just by going through the first roughly 2 minutes of the game. So first, Tyler Spano, who won 16 to 22 faceoffs against Richmond and was enormous. That was going to be a big question mark coming in because Brady Wambach is the best faceoff guy in college across, and Aiden Diaz-Matos, the highest ranked faceoff guy in the 2025 class, a freshman, has been hurt for the last three games. Tyler Spano is a Washington and Lee transfer, not a normal pathway to the highest ends of Division I faceoff specialty, and clearly is getting better as the season goes along. And I think his final numbers were 10 of 16. He won the opening faceoff forward, took a shot. Josh Marcus saved it, and we'll get a little bit more into that. Carolina cleared, and then that's going to set up what I felt like was the most important overarching theme for the game, which was effectively Notre Dame's defensive game plan and how to deal with Carolina, because it goes back to the point that we started with in terms of the enmity between these two teams, or at least how it manifested outwardly with this particular group of Notre Dame defenders. But I do want to just include that Spano won six of the first nine. Carolina went to Colin Hannigan, who is a senior who hadn't taken very many faceoffs. They did have some success. Parker Hoffman scored a goal off the wing, but it was a battle. It was impressive. There was nothing about it that felt like it wasn't fluky, or it was fluky, right? It was you know, it wasn't as if it was an over reliance on wings. I think of the 10 wins, Spano picked up six ground balls. So, you know, it was like I said, went out the front door, counter, just, you know, beat him to a 50-50 ground ball. It was everything that you would want to see from a sustainable model from a faceoff specialist. And that was, you know, Kevin Corrigan's wisdom doesn't get the credit that it deserves. He called me, or Inside Lacrosse, out post-game, the broadcast, by effectively the amount of emphasis that was put on the face-off situation heading into this game, basically pointing out it's a matchup-dependent circumstance. Yeah, like, it wasn't going to be an ideal situation for Notre Dame not having Diaz Matos, but at the same time, they had no idea what Spanos was going to be able to do, and obviously he's coming off an awesome game, so who knows? Yeah, Brady Wambach, great player, doesn't mean he's going to have a great day against Notre Dame, and ultimately that's what manifested. So I think that, you know, even-keeled approach, maybe stoic, which was a conversation that he and I had over the weekend, might have been a contributing factor in terms of the success that Notre Dame found in the possession battle. But before we got to get into it. So Notre Dame's defense over the last 15 years, one of the sources of success has come from the short 60 midfield play. And Ben Ramsey was the latest in the lineage of really, really high-end players. And then Tyler Buchner, obviously one of the more interesting stories in college sports over the last 5 years, emerged as another known commodity for Notre Dame last season. He did not get an additional year of eligibility to play this year, which I personally think is absurd, because he did not play 4 years of college lacrosse. But with that being said, Chris Reinhart, Christian Alakwa, and Kyle Bergen were the familiar faces coming back, but on a relative basis, right? They weren't Aidan McGuire. They weren't Jack Pilling. You know, they weren't Eric Kolar, John King. Like, they were just better known short stick D midfielders heading into the season. And I think, at least from a award standpoint, preseason All-American, even midseason All-American, I kind of adopt that approach of I just want to see a little bit more out of them. Well, I saw it, and it started on the very first possession. Christian Alakwa, ball hits the ground after Don Petromala mishandles a pass, kind of in that high pocket, that high wing shot that he loves so much. And the ground ball scrum, there were a couple of liberties taken with Petromala. And it wasn't just the hits either. It was also the amount of behind-the-clear talking that Alakwa and then subsequently Will Donovan got involved in. And it was impossible to see that and not come away with the conclusion that it's a huge part of what Notre Dame wants to do here is get underneath Petro's skin. And he threw a couple butt ends in that sequence. He threw a couple butt ends on the next possession. And then the third possession after that, he had already scored because he scored. He ended up shooting 1-for-10. And his goal came off, I believe, his first shot, which was a low-to-low rocket from the point on extra man. But then a sequence later, he got called for a slash. And to me, it was like a really good illustration of this is what they wanted to do, and it was working. And I feel like, you know, a 1-for-10 shooting performance, like, it's not the only time we've ever seen Dom do this. I don't want to say that they, like, took him out of it. And, you know, he had that one really pretty behind the back on the crease that hit Thomas Richardelli in the chest. But Notre Dame wanted to bully North Carolina. It was obvious. And when you break it down into the component parts, you know, you can talk about the job that Sean Light did guarding Owen Duffy. Owen Duffy got switched onto short sticks a couple times and wasn't able to turn that into offense. So it's not as if Light deserves all the credit for limiting Duffy to 1-1 and talked about, you know, post game how disappointed he was that Duffy got the goal on him in a 1-on-1 setting. It was an all around nails defensive performance against a team that was the number three scoring offense coming in, averaged 14.8 goals per game, and had not been held to single digits so far this season. I think I struck a couple chords in there with the things that Nick Cassella likes to hear about Notre Dame. So I'll just give you the floor to react.
Two things. One, not all home game advantages are created equal in the sense that, you know, if you're playing in South Bend in February indoors, you're kind of, all right, this is great. Arlotta was packed. And from the mindset of a short stick D midi, you know, you are reading the articles and you are hearing the scouting reports and you're hearing how good this UNC offense is, how good Petromala is at shooting, how good Duffy is at initiating, how good this unit is at finding skips. And by the time it's game time, you've almost taken personal offense to this assumption that they're going to steamroll your defense or at least have a good game. So like the mindset of the short stick D midi unit, I wouldn't be surprised if, like, you know, all three or four of them were getting together before the game and going, this is our chance. And I'm sure it was just profanity laden. We hate these guys. We know who we hate. We know what our job is. And our job is to go and bully and hurt and scrap and fight and bite and claw. And it's such a fun way to do it, especially when you have the home crowd that was max capacity, and especially to your point when it works. That was the most surprising part to me, was this brand of bully ball. It's kind of playing with fire. You can find yourself quickly down two or three with man up opportunities for UNC, or you can overextend yourself, and the caliber of player that UNC has could very easily turn your aggression into open spots for them to capitalize on. So I loved the contained anger with which they played. And I got to give credit to both sides of the ball. It seemed like both defenses, you know, when the game is as physical as it is, offenses get a little bit sloppier. You know, they're kind of waiting for the big hit and not really expecting or defending against the poke checks as well. So there were a couple interesting turnovers throughout the game. But to me, what I loved was the amount of interference that both defenses had, but in particular Notre Dame's. When you slide and you're the on-ball defender, you know that slide's coming. You know that you're going to have to recover. But sometimes what gets lost in all of that is don't recover too early. And as the ball carrier gets ready to make a pass, if you can disrupt their ability to make a quality pass, that is the true secret sauce of good defense. Because UNC's offense has thrived on their ability to find these open shooters and to kind of have you know, death by committee of their offense. You take away one, somebody else pops up. But if you take away their ability to make an effective pass through the heart of the defense or to the next guy, it's the difference between Petromala catching it in the box and catching it at his ankles. And I thought that in all of this anger and aggression and, you know, helmet to helmet and high and late and the crowds, you know, oohing and aahing, and you want to go out there and kill somebody, but you know that you can't get a penalty, it was their ability to disrupt the flow of those passes that held the best offense in college lacrosse to five goals. A brilliant performance from Ricciardelli and a brilliant performance from the defensive unit. And to your point as well, this is a sustainable path for Notre Dame. I didn't understand how you could limit UNC, because I figured that heading into this game, it would almost be UNC's turn to have a 3 to 5 minute run that we've kind of typically seen from Notre Dame this year. Like, the offense sucks, but for 5 minutes, they put up eight goals. You know, it's kind of how we beat Richmond. Yeah. And I was kind of waiting for it all game. Just, okay, when is Wombat going to get hot? When is the offense going to get hot? And how are we going to manage, you know, the momentum that UNC can create? And it just never happened, whether it was a save, whether it was a face-off, or whether it was great 6-on-6 defense. A complete game and an inarguable number one. So I'm fired up about this, and this will be the game that, if Notre Dame isn't cutting the nets in May, this is the game that's going to break my heart.
That's a very good final point. I want to point to a particular sequence, which I think that moment when it felt like Carolina could have gone on that run probably would have come at some point in the last 4 minutes of the third quarter after Luke Macaluso scored to cut it to 6-5. And Luke Miller, who, you know, you can point to the fact that Notre Dame scored 10 goals. They scored 10 goals in 44 minutes because it took 16 minutes to get on the board to start the game. They felt like they were getting their shots, so they weren't pressing the panic button. But at the same time, I don't think that, and I asked him post-game, and he confirmed, Luke Miller, who is a lefty shooter scorer that we've talked about a lot on this podcast, probably didn't expect to open the scoring with a nice ISO take from X and a low-to-low finish. He probably also didn't expect to score what you could potentially argue was the most pivotal goal of the game, the one that made it 7-5 with a little less than 2 minutes to go in the third quarter, down with a lefty alley dodge that he threw a Hezzy in on, and this was the goal, if you remember, that barely snuck past the goal line. And so Luke Miller finished with 3 goals. Teddy Lally, the freshman, finished with 3 goals. Kevin Corrigan hilariously referred to his last couple games as terrible when citing the kind of normal freshman season that he was on. And then I just want to shout out Josh Yago, second lieutenant in the Space Force on Military Appreciation Day, finished with 3 assists, but also picked up a couple ground balls and caused a turnover. And, you know, so I think he's up to 32 points in 9 games, which is, you know, not eye-popping numbers. I think that probably puts him in around the 50s in terms of scoring average. But as of last week, he was, I believe, 7th among attackmen in our fantasy scoring system, which is, in my opinion, a nice weight for not committing turnovers, causing turnovers, and picking up ground balls. And 2 days before the PLL draft, able to report that he is going to be allowed to play pro this summer. He's gotten permission from Space Force. And the thing about it is not just that diversified production that I talked about, and Casey talked about it post-game with respect to how comfortable it is knowing that he's going to get the opponent's number one defenseman. So we're not going to have to worry about how that matchup is going to shake out in terms of the rest of the offense, but also in terms of the other things that he can do, like those ground balls, cause turnovers, picks, other types of effort plays on the ride, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's one reason that he is a potential pro. Another reason is that he is pretty clearly, you know, kind of a hybrid attackman midfielder, which means he's just an offensive player, which is always really useful when it comes to pros. But the last thing is, and I was texting you about this yesterday, there are some guys that just athletically look different. And when you get an opportunity to see them at field level, it stands out. And he is one of those guys. And so very curious to see, you know, the military obligation has been an interesting thing when it comes to pro lacrosse over the last 25 years. We've seen guys like Brennan Nickturn or Jackson Eicher make contributions that effectively vindicated maybe like kind of back end of the draft capital, even if you're only going to get it for a year or two. And if that's the case with Yago, it'll just be an interesting question to see whether or not anybody does the assessment, especially given the PLL season is going to start earlier. So assuming Notre Dame plays into May, you're already losing a little bit of that rookie season contribution that you otherwise wouldn't have in prior years when the season started later. So just an interesting kind of consideration matrix there. But that's my assessment of the Notre Dame offense. Great days from Miller and Lally, and then Yago with some of the dirty hidden plays.
And a quick funny story. I mean, I've already mentioned it, but Yago being from the same area, Wheat Ridge, Colorado, his dad was instrumental in getting the youth lacrosse scene going and to the size and scale that it is now. Great family, and you're not going to find a nicer kid than Yago. Like, even when I try and bust his chops when we see each other rarely in person, he just kind of is like, like, I'm not really into banter. I'm just a nice guy. And I'm like, oh. And I can't remember if it was Ryder Garnsey or Coach Wellner. They said, yeah, we knew that we needed to recruit more kids from the Wheat Ridge area. We just had to wait for one to be a good person. So I thought that was a funny little that had to have been Garnsey when I was there in January.
Yeah, that seems like a Ryder comment.
Yeah. But regarding the offense, I thought it was a good showing for, again, it's a sustainable win. You know, they did enough and enough individual contributions. I think we kind of saw UNC, you know, again, the blueprint of play bully ball. And if you can impact the quality of those passes, you know, what was most interesting to me was that there wasn't, outside of, you know, a handful, Duffy's goal on light, there wasn't the individual that could make a play when needed. And it seemed like Notre Dame had that caliber on the flip side. What a game. And if you let me keep talking about this, this will be an hour. Because another point that we didn't really touch on in the open, but we talked about before recording, this was, and I think this just made me love the slate even more this weekend. The crowds were out and about, and I love a stacked Arlotta, and we'll probably have a story or two to wrap up the podcast. But I think the story was the Army-Navy game. If you saw that crowd, what was the tally? 15,000 people?
Yeah.
Oh, incredible. We should talk about that game a little bit.
Yeah, so the final score was Army 14, Navy 9, and it started in a way that most Army-Navy games do, which is it was not going to be easy for the team that came in favored, which was the Black Knights. Jack Flaherty got Navy on the board first, and then he also put them up 3-2 after Hill Plunkett had responded with a pair of goals. I thought Ryan Powell did a really nice job talking about how Hill Plunkett was doing a really good job of placing his shots, especially against Dan Daly's replacement, George Halos, I believe. I don't feel comfortable pronouncing his last name, but either way, the run that you talked about being afraid that North Carolina was going to go on is what ended up happening in the call it 7-minute mark of the first quarter to the 7-minute mark of the second quarter, and that's when Army built, let's see, a 7-3 lead. Nicolini got one back, and then ultimately the Black Knights were able to score three straight in the fourth to build a 10-4 lead and really kind of salt the game away in the fourth. So another big win for the Black Knights, their fourth straight in this series, and illustrating, I think, what has been the theme for Army this season, which is how do you graduate all of the talent that they did last year, led by Jackson Eicher, but you know, certainly you know, Christian Mazur and you know, unbelievable contributions from the midfield and the rope unit and down low. But you come back with the Plunketts and Sean Byrne and John Sullivan and Braden Fountain, and so you've got plenty of pieces. And I think ultimately that was effectively what I saw when it came to analyzing this game, which was Army is just a more talented team. And that talent showed out over the course of 60 minutes in a way that the pride and the emotion of the game doesn't really allow to immediately come to the surface in the first, call it, 5 to 10 minutes.
Well, there are always, I feel, two ways that this game takes shape. And we'll throw Air Force in there. The size and scale and pageantry of the game takes precedent, and it's a dogfight from the first whistle until whoever wins by one goal, either late in the fourth or in overtime. But, you know, to your point, just it was a pretty clear example to me of one team just has more talent. And my favorite part of this, and I am going to make that joke, Army coach after the game, he was quoted saying, "You got to control the ground if you're going to win a game like this." But enough about Iran. We also played pretty well today too. I just thought it was a great little cherry on top of an Army coach saying, "You got to control the ground if you're going to win a game." And I think if this game was played in the ocean, I think it would give Navy a bigger advantage.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Maybe we can consider.
And that's why you come to the Tailgate Podcast.
I just want to the point I made about Iago in terms of pro prospects, want to shout out Plunkett as well. He finished with 3 goals and 3 assists, 2 ground balls, a cause turnover, committed 2 turnovers. And for me, just the best all-around midfielder in college lacrosse. I don't think there's anybody else that has the
special
offensive acuity, but then also the ability to – he was – if you're coming out of a timeout down one with less time on the game clock than you have on the shot clock, you got to cause a turnover and get to the other end of the field. He is absolutely out there taking that possession. And if it's a tie game with 30 seconds to go, he's taking the wing of the faceoff. Evan Plunkett is a consummate lacrosse player, the likes of which are romanticized by people who have loved this sport for 60, 75 years, and the likes of which there aren't that many more. And people lament that the reason there aren't that many of them is because of some, you know, way in which the rules or the, you know, stick technology or specialization has changed. No, the reason there aren't guys like that is because the game has gotten harder and those guys are rare. And that's why Evan Plunkett deserves to be celebrated, especially given, you know, he just completed a 4-year tenure of never losing to Navy.
I love that argument, and you can just tell that it's somebody who's shaking their fist at this guy. Whatever happened to two-way middies? And I'm like, buddy, have you seen what offensive players are doing now? And right. You expect someone to play defense? Shut up. I love, and it doesn't happen often, but I love getting into those. Now, moving on, what was really funny is this morning, before recording, I made the comment, I have no clue what's going on in the Ivy League. You rightfully assumed that that just means I wasn't paying attention to the games, which I didn't take offense to. I actually handled with a lot of grace, credit to me.
You were very graceful, for sure.
But more so, I was saying I was following the games. We kind of alluded to Dartmouth Brown being absolutely drunk for the fourth quarter of that game. But the surprising one, Yale and Harvard. So I have no idea what's going on in the Ivy League because they're all just taking a baseball bat and meeting in a back alley and beating each other up. Yale's defense might be the story of the weekend in their 15-9 win over Harvard.
Yeah, it was impressive. It was one of those games where you felt like you might as well just call it after 40 minutes because the margin was too big based on how Harvard was going to be able to find ways back in. And it's important because it's been the storyline for these Yale Bulldogs since they won the 2018 National Championship. Even their 2019 team, their defense was so protected by T.D. Erland that their metrics did not measure up to who they had been previously. And what's interesting about it, and you know, obviously there's a storyline with respect to assistant coaches with Andrew Baxter moving on to become the head coach at Fairfield and then Ed Williams taking over for him. And then now this past offseason transitioning from Williams to Noah Faustner. But the question that I always started from was that Andy Shea has what he calls transition rules, and it's effectively it's not actually about going from defense to offense. It's an overall mindset of how you play the game. It is very much a front foot attacking mindset. And for me, over the last 5-6 years, as I've watched this team, and they've, you know, struggled and been in the mid-30s from a defensive efficiency standpoint, my question has been, is it inherent when you play as fast and you're willing to take so many transition opportunities and you're shooting so early in the shot clock, is it inherent that you're going to have a defense that is just that efficient? I understand that the best thing about efficiency relative to raw scoring percentage or raw scoring averages is that it accounts for short possessions because you're playing more possessions, right? So you might have a higher numerator, but you're going to have a higher denominator as well. And so it means that the percentage is going to be a better indication as to how you're actually performing. But the problem is fatigue. And it makes cowards of us all. And that is, again, coming back to the fundamental question. I don't know that I have an answer for that because I don't think this offense is playing as fast as the Matt Brandao 23-24 offenses were. But with that being said, it is so obvious to me that the stickiness on ball and then the buttoned-upness off ball of this has persisted and gotten better. This Yale team has gotten good defensive performances in some games because of Ben Friedman's outsized impact on the outcome. That was not the case against Harvard. He made 11 saves and let in 9 goals. Good day. I'm not going to like poo-poo a 55-ish percent day, but that's not what won them the game. What won them the game was, I guess, kind of the multitude of everything, right? Like, you know, they faced off well and they, you know, cleared against a interesting Harvard ride, which I can address a little bit. But for me, what sealed the win was not giving up anything easy off ball. I do want to point out that Harvard employed a pretty interesting match feet 9.5 or 10 man ride, which allowed Yale to keep Harvard's offensive midfielders, which, you know, we've talked about it all season. Their first midfield might be the best in all of college lacrosse. John Oren, Andrew Perry, and Logan Ipp. And really sap the energy of those guys late. And I think that was another factor in why Yale's defense looked so sticky, because they short-sticked Nate Cobery, and the amount of advantages that those Harvard midfielders were able to get were far more limited because they just didn't have the burst late in the game that they did early in the game, because they had been put in the position to, if not play defense, then at least be on the field, not on the sidelines, getting their energy levels back up. And that was another important factor in the outcome. So I think if you're a Yale fan, you can't really identify this as anything other than just consistent progress as the season's gone along. I came away from the Penn State game thinking that this was a rebuilding year and that there could be signs of progress. But after they lost to Penn, I was less than 50-50. Yale had a legit shot at making the Ivy League tournament. Now, if they beat Brown in their Ivy League regular season finale, they make the Ivy League tournament. And anybody that knows anything about the Yale program knows that making the Ivy League tournament was the foundation upon which a national champion and a national runner-up team was built over the course of a decade. And it feels like the typewriter is kind of shifting back a little to that. And given a lot of the stories that have been written over the last 2 weeks about what's going on in the athletic department from a, you know, top-down administration level, it's got to feel good to get these wins, regardless of who you are in and around the program, because especially coming over your rival at home in front of 2,000 fans, a really good day in New Haven.
So I watched the second and third quarter of this, and usually I watch the offense, defense, and try to, like, when it's 6-on-6, I try to kind of forecast, okay, what is each team going to find consistent success with? The most impressive thing about Yale's defense was and I'll talk about the impact of that 10-man ride here shortly, but you commented on the stickiness, but even when they created separation, there was just, to your point, never an easy, here's a way that we can sustain offensive success. And Harvard's offense is no slouch.
No doubt.
You know, they are a good offensive team. They proved that over the course of this year. And every time I would hit pause kind of during the slide and recovery is, you know, I'll just analyze it for 3-4 seconds. I was like, if I'm the ball carrier, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to consistently look for, even after beating my guy.
Do I want to roll back? Is that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, they kind of work on a relatively, like, rote game flow pattern where it's like they want to get unassisted goals for their midfielders early so that they can then turn into passers and get Jack Spidell these open looks on the backside, and then he's going to score 6 goals. And that's where you kind of have to have both, right? You have to have the ability to get the separation, can your shot, put the defense in a position where they have to decide whether or not they want to go, and now all of a sudden they're going off guys that they don't want to go to, and you're getting those angle passes that then end up with the backside looks, which Yale had been so susceptible to giving up over the course of the last several years. And I agree with you. I didn't see a lot of those angles emerging over the course of the game.
Well, and it was the hardest part to me was, like, when does Yale decide to go because of that stickiness? You know, it's almost counterintuitive sometimes where it's like, hey, you either want to get beat or you want it to be not a clear slide so that it's an easy slide decision. And I'm like, but if you're taking away everything else.
We have a Jerry Byrne disciple on the podcast right now. I can hear it.
I'm like, it was honestly the toughest part about sliding to Jack Neer when he was on. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I trust him. He's not going to get toasted. But, you know, against the Miles Jones, he can shoot kind of that stickiness. But I digress. The second part, it's the point in the season, and maybe it's just because I am now a fat guy and I'm just viewing my in shape in college through a bit of a lens, but I think most players would agree with me that you become a very specific type of in shape. And that type of in shape fits a certain span of how the game goes through. So, like, a 10-man ride right? If we were deploying that, I knew that it was the fourth quarter and all we had to do was gut it out. But there were certain times when there would be a 10-man ride either in the first half or earlier than we would expect it. And, you know, like whether it's on a face-off, whether it's on a 10-man ride, that matters, I think, significantly more than what might appear on film, because those additional 15 to 20 seconds as they compound over the course of the game, like it might sound weird, but like your body's not going to handle that. Your body is used to, okay, I need to sprint off the field, which I'm more than capable of doing. And then I can get my, you know, I can inflate the lungs a little bit. Those extra 15 to 20 seconds, especially when there's like lateral agility involved and there's guys cutting and you have to plant, it will sap the energy out of your legs way quicker than you might experience. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, you know, Yale deploy that a little bit more in the future.
Well, and especially when the weather starts to go from 45 degrees to 65 or 70 degrees, right? And you're just losing so much more water. And then, you know, you have to replenish that. But at the same time, then you start to feel a little waterlogged. And that's not good when it's the middle of the third quarter and you're like, oh, man, I've like... So it's this balance. And I think as it gets hotter, you get used to it and you're practicing it in every day. So counterintuitively, it actually gets easier. So there's this transition moment that depending on where in the country you are and whether or not you practice inside or outside, you're kind of going through. And I think you've heard about it. You know, certainly we've heard about it with respect to Syracuse, and we'll get to them in a second with respect to their different performances inside versus out. But yeah, I you know, and ultimately, I think here we are, right? Like when it comes down to Harvard, their resume is being poo-pooed because they've now lost two one-sided games in a three-game stretch, and then the other didn't look great in their win over Brown. And still, they've got three top 20 wins and a win over Syracuse that is right there in that top five to top 10 win threshold. The bubble is not getting better. These bubble teams are not separating from the next tier, which means that like nobody is really getting eliminated from consideration. Penn State lost its third non-top 20 or third game to a non-top 20 opponent. I don't think a team has ever gotten an at-large bid with three non-top 20 losses, and yet they have five top 20 wins and wins over pretty much everybody they're competing with for a bubble spot. So it's going to be really interesting to see how this bracket continues to project. And ultimately, the Ivy League and Harvard in particular are going to be right at the center of this combination of how is Duke's resume going to come together if it comes together at all? How is the Big Ten multi-bid thing going to shake out when if Maryland and then whichever between Hopkins and Ohio State's resume starts to elevate the most, does one of those teams win the AQ or not? And then obviously, of course, whether Richmond wins the A10 AQ. So we're going to talk more about that over the course of the next 2 to 3 weeks. Podcasts are always the toughest format because it's keeping too many numbers in your brain. But we can save that and move on to the drama in Providence, where you accurately described a game as being drunk.
I mean, and again, I am so bummed. And we'll start off next week's episode just to get Larkin his just desserts on this, because the group chat was active and it was not in a good way going, hey, you guys are down 15-8. Yeah. And there's 5 minutes left in the third quarter. Larkin, hang in there, buddy. And then all of a sudden, watch out. Here comes Torpy's crew. Just, okay, well, they might have, but there's just no way. You know, they're kind of now within striking distance, but it's going to be a collapse. Now they're just getting Larkin's hopes up for the inevitable disaster, all the way to a 16-15 overtime winner.
No.
I can't.
17-16 overtime.
17-16 overtime winner.
You left out.
I'm so close.
The very well, but it's important because it was 16-15 with 40 seconds left, and Brown had an opportunity to win the game. And here comes Dartmouth in transition. Thomas Power, 35 seconds. Boom. 16-16. We're going to overtime, and that was just the cherry on top. So the ice cream sundae is the combination of Brown, who Charlie Cave and Connor Foley were the two best known commodities coming into the season, and Cave struggled with injuries. You know, Foley hadn't been quite as good as he was last year, but certainly on a relative basis was a stalwart. They make the change, go to Tucker Williams because they weren't getting what they needed out of Foley. First of all, shout out to him. I mentioned last week how many goalies I like stylistically, and I mentioned Jimmy McCool and the way I appreciated how he reacted to getting pulled against Carolina. Connor Foley was the most engaged Brown player on the sideline as this comeback was going on. So shout out to him. That was awesome to see and totally incredible. But in addition to that, one of the things that was really significant was Spencer Regan, Dartmouth's faceoff guy, gets injured and Henry Bear just takes over. And that is what fed this 8-goal run from the 3:18 mark of the third quarter to the 3-minute mark of the fourth quarter when Marcus Wertheim had a nice little left to right shake and hammered a step down that looked like it was going to be the ultimate game winner. I project that Wertheim's going to get drafted in the PLL on Tuesday, and it was like, what a week. A prospective game winner and potentially becoming a pro lacrosse player. Ultimately, as I mentioned, Thomas Power made sure that was not the overtime winner, but it was Ben Scandone who fed Brady O'Kane about 30 seconds into overtime that keyed off a pretty awesome to see Brown celebration and got Torpy his first Ivy League win in his second season.
And talking about that celebration, like it's what makes, I think, college sports so special is you saw how much that win meant to Brown. When that goal went in, helmet off, and it was just everybody start sprinting to somewhere. Who knows where? I don't care. We're just running. You know,
it just... My favorite part about it is how it becomes self-preservation for the goal scorer. He's not running to anywhere. He's running away from 35 guys who want to tackle him and jump on him and make sure that he's on the bottom. And oh, by the way, he already took his helmet off, and pretty much nobody else did, which means that he's the most exposed. I feel so bad for guys in that situation, but Larkin uses the term dogpile all the time. And yeah, I don't want to get dogpiled on. I just won this game. Can't we just jump around? I feel like it's a survival instinct.
And it's just predator versus prey. Everybody go and take this guy's head off. Let's dogpile him, and he's running for his life. And you know, a testament. We were talking about how we have no clue what's going on in the Ivy League and how they're all beating each other up. But for Brown to complete this comeback, you know, that's going to be something that's talked about with that group of guys. You know, hey, you remember that terrible season, but man, you remember those 30 seconds after we, you know, after we beat Dartmouth. I'm really happy that they got it. I'm happy for Larkin. And we'll see who on the Ivy League is going to take, you know, who's going to beat who. I have no idea, because I thought Cornell wasn't that good, and then they proved me wrong this weekend.
I mean, or Duke's just not that good. That possibility exists.
But Duke's in the ACC, and every ACC team is great. Come on. But no, I mean, I'll let you do the game recap, but this one was a bit of a surprising, narrative-breaking game for me, at least.
So the final of the Corgan Sports live series for this season, 3,800 fans in attendance at LIU Shark Stadium. A game of runs, you know, a lot of 2 and 3 goal kind of trading back and forth. Ultimately, Duke was never able to get over the hump and take the lead in the second half. You could probably isolate Cornell's 3-goal run to start the third quarter as being the most significant factor in deciding the outcome. I didn't get an opportunity to see this game. I haven't watched film yet, so I don't want to speak too much about it. But Dan Abram was there. He shot highlights. I watched those. It came across as really physical. He talked to Connor Busick post game. Busick's comments suggested that he was pleased with the toughness his team showed, the urgency they showed, and the way that they responded. You know, this is a team that, that has had a lot of injuries. We've talked about Brennan Urie. We've talked about Jack Haskadden, Ike Lonas, starting defenseman, had missed a couple of games. So I think the main theme of this for me, it, from a Cornell perspective, is it's hard to defend a title, and it's especially hard to do so when you have this talismanic player like CJ Kirst that you have to figure out how to replace, and he's basically irreplaceable. And winning games like this are a demonstration of doing the hard thing. And at the other end of the field, I think the narrative was how reliant, and this has been the case, Quinn's talked about this in multiple columns for Duke over the course of the last several weeks, how reliant they are on Ben Johnston and Max Sloat for goals, and how difficult it is to find offensive production elsewhere on the roster. And this was another game, not just in terms of the production, but also in terms of the shots. I think it was College Cross that tweeted that those two have taken more than 25% of the team's total shots over the course of the last four games. Like, just makes it too easy to game plan for. And now they're in a position where they have Duke and Carolina remaining in the regular season. I'm sorry, Duke has Notre Dame this weekend and Carolina the following, remaining in the ACC regular season. The ACC tournament permutations would be too difficult to forecast right now. If they win one of those games, then they would be questionably in based on tiebreakers. I would assume that it's unlikely, given that, you know, if they beat Notre Dame, well, Notre Dame already has two wins, so there's really no way that they would be tied at 1-3, right? And get that head-to-head benefit. And then equivalently, Carolina already are also, let's see, so they've got one win over Syracuse, so they're 1-1 in the ACC, and they've got Virginia up next. So there would be a scenario in that instance where they could be, if they lose to Virginia, 1-2 playing Duke, and then, as kind of hard to imagine as that might be, if Duke beats them, they both finish tied for 1-3. Duke gets the head-to-head, they get the fourth spot in the ACC tournament. And in that scenario, now all of a sudden, you've got a quality win over Carolina, and then the opportunity to get one or two additional quality wins. Three quality wins, if they win the ACC and don't get the AQ, that could be a tournament resume, right? So, you know, right now they just don't have metrics in addition to wins. But if they were to stack wins, their metrics would get better as well. So they're not out of it. But again, the path toward remaining in it is shrinking. And that's the big storyline here for the Blue Devils. And again, you know, kind of going back to the point about the Ivy League's role in the at-large conversation and the Big Ten's role in the at-large conversation, you know, Duke represents a really important looming either threat or absence of a threat. You know, if ultimately they lose these next two games, they're just not going to be in the conversation whatsoever. And that is going to give a lot of relief to the likes of, you know, the Ohio States, the Hopkins, the Harvards of the world that, you know, right now fancy themselves in that spot and would rather not have to compete with the Blue Devils for it.
Yeah. And we, you know, a talking point last week was, you know, Virginia takes down Duke. Virginia's red hot. Did Duke, as a product of their schedule, just not have enough quality games to be able to make those adjustments to the Syracuse's, Virginia's, Cornell's, Notre Dame's, Carolina's of the world? Might be coming to fruition. You know, this is a game, to your point, I was only able to catch the highlights, but I'm going to be watching that game kind of more with a critical eye. And one of the things that I kind of really like about this time of year too is we're starting to get clarity on how much weight we need to put into the performances of February and March. Because it's becoming more head-scratching how Penn State, you know, took Cornell to the woodshed. What was that performance? You know, they lost a close game to Richmond, get smoked by Penn State, and then lose a nail-biter to Yale, which is looking better and better. So I just really like kind of going and revisiting. And it seems like most teams kind of have that head-scratching game. Penn State, 19-7 over Cornell. What does that mean? I don't know. And this is a weekly thing, wide open. Terry, you nailed it at the beginning of the season, and credit to you for doing so. For those that are listening, Terry just put the cover of the preseason issue up in which it says wide open, and that's the recurring theme this year.
Let's get into a closed space, which is the JMA Wireless Dome, where there were 8,900 fans to watch Syracuse conclude a 14-9 victory over the Virginia Cavaliers. For me, this was a game that, you know, I had it on the second screen while the Notre Dame Carolina game was going on. And it was interesting because they brought John Desko into the booth for the fourth quarter. And it felt like while they were interviewing him, like all the action on the field basically stopped. It was crazy. It was it felt like a three-quarter game. And, you know, at the conclusion of three quarters, let's see, Syracuse was up 11-9. Or, nope, excuse me, 13-9. There was only one goal scored in the fourth quarter. It's unbelievable. The game went almost 15 minutes, when 13-15 without a goal in the fourth quarter. So, you know, ultimately, I thought Syracuse's offense looked like they wanted to look like. And that's an interesting dynamic with respect to the defensive principles that Virginia plays with relative to what Carolina plays with, because last week they were completely out of sorts. And again, you know, there is a certain fan base, there's a section of the fan base, lacrosse fan base, who's going to say, it's not about tactics, it's not about matchups, it's not about personnel. It's about the fact that Syracuse can't play outside. And maybe that's true. I'm not in a position to argue it. I just don't like it as analysis because it's just too simple, right? It feels reductive. But they got Joey Spallina going as a facilitator and, you know, Luke Rowe and Michael Leo as shooters. And that's who they want to be. You know, Finn Thompson as a finisher. Virginia didn't get the saves that they had been getting. You know, Jake Merrick had been a story over the course of the preceding month or so. And Jimmy McCool had a great game. And shout out to his candor post game when he referenced the new Tame. Is it Tame Impala? I'm not cool enough to know who this band is.
Yeah, Tame Impala, really good. I encourage you to go listen to them. So for those that didn't know, Jimmy McCool's girlfriend got him a record player, and he listened to Tame Impala's new album with all the lights off in his dorm room. When I read that, I don't miss college. I think it's kind of embarrassing when people are, you know, still trying to relive the glory days. I saw that and I'm like, man, to just have one of the days where your girlfriend gets you a record player, you turn off all the lights and you're just laying in your dorm room listening to Tame Impala. I was like, oh, I'd give anything to go back. And credit to him too. He got, he picked up some Pearl Jam and some Jim Croce, and Soundgarden was also. And I'm like, dude, you're putting together quite the stack right there. Listening to Bad Bad Leroy Brown on your new vinyl record player in your dorm room. I mean, you know, of course he was going to have a good game. As far as analysis goes, I think you hit the nail on the head with this felt like the right version of Syracuse's offense. I think there's a right version and a wrong version. When Spallina is the distributor and all the pieces are playing their own role, it's a really pretty offense to watch. And I think the game plan for how to stop that has been written. And I just don't think that Virginia executed taking away the areas with which their caliber of player are most comfortable thriving in. And yeah, the goalie battle kind of being the second piece of it. McCool's on fire. And the final point to that, I'm always curious how goalies are going to bounce back from a bad game, especially collegiate goalies. So while it's kind of funny to say, oh, well, you know, if a goalie has a bad game, just get him a record player. It was really impressive to see the maturation start from the moment the game started, just saying, hey, I had a bad game. It's clearly out of my system. And I don't think there were any bad goals that I can remember. So good for him. And I think that's a huge green flag in a goalie, because sometimes one bad game for a faceoff guy or a goalie kind of leads to the snowball effect of there goes the season.
And with Penn coming to Stevenson Pinsens Field, perhaps next week we will be asking Connor Foley what record he listened to in a dark room at some point one day this week. We're going to finish this up by just quickly wrapping through the Big Ten. The day started with a very narrow Ohio State win over Johns Hopkins, which included a pair of Caleb Fiak doorstop saves of Hunter Chivett, one in the last 5 seconds that would have tied the game. So a big win and a continuation of the seesaw in league seasons for both teams. By far the most eyebrow raising and significant result of the day was Michigan's upset victory over Penn State in front of 2,000 fans in Happy Valley. That win, 9-8, and another come from behind as it looked like Penn State had taken control, I believe leading 8-6 with not a ton of time left in that one. And then the day ended with Maryland's 12-2 victory over Rutgers. And the reaction to that is Maryland is turning into form or rounding into form, turning into shape as the NCAA tournament Big Ten and NCAA tournaments come into sight. So, Nick, your thought on the Big Ten in general?
Love it. It's just wing T meets wing
chaos
T.
Chaos factory.
Just chaos. I'm nothing if not biased towards people I like. So watching Michigan get the win over Penn State and knowing what it means for that coaching staff and that program, loved it. And when I was talking to them, I watched one of their practices in January. And when I was getting beers with the staff afterwards, what a great group just for sitting in bolt and shooting the moon, shooting the breeze, we'll say. Almost just got the explicit tag on it. But second, I was kind of curious about how they expected their season to play out. And they said, we have a good goaltender. Liam Entman said that he's great. I'll trust him for that. And this is the game that, now two in a row that they kind of just need to emulate. They know we're not the team that's going to beat the brakes off of people, but we think we can get some teams into some really interesting positions close late in the game. And we have a couple playmakers. So to see Shanahan, with a really impressive game winner, totally. Dodges, rolls back, beats the double and gets the shot off. It was good to see Michigan's game plan from the get-go starting to come to fruition with back-to-back wins over Rutgers and Penn State. And then Ohio State is, to me, one of the most dangerous teams in all of college lacrosse right now. They are going to drag you into a somewhere between a 5 and 9 goal rock fight. And every weekend, it's just going to be a coin flip for them. When you have Fiak, when you have that defense, no team is safe, especially now that we've seen, Notre Dame's game plan against UNC. I was like, well, Ohio State would never beat a UNC. Who knows? They might win 8-6, 8-7. And then finally, Maryland coming into shape, holding any Division I team to 2 goals, let alone Rutgers. Yikes. I didn't watch that one. I don't know if I want to watch that one. but I love it. Just Ivy League, Big Ten, absolute disasters, train wrecks, and I can't look away.
I'm going to guess that the Rutgers offensive players are not going to want to watch that one in film today or tomorrow. Yeah. A couple other results that I want to quickly shout out. So Providence, overtime winner, comeback against Villanova. That throws the Big East into interesting standings. We've made we've brought up several times how head-scratching this season is for Delaware. 8-7 victors at UMass. Really, again, kind of an A-10 head-scratcher. And then Loyola continues to kind of in a Yale, similar to Yale type way, a little bit below the service. They don't have that, kind of marquee top 20 win yet. They have a couple opportunities here coming up on the horizon. They continue to demonstrate their prowess with a 16-7 victory over Lafayette. So we're getting into it, buddy. This time next week, we'll have talked about a lot of Friday lacrosse.
Friday slate on deck, and Princeton showing out again. A 20-8 victory over UPenn, and Princeton's ability to just put up this is what, their third 20 burger this season. Really curious how they're going to stack up against Harvard next week. But don't sleep on those Tigers. I'm scared and I'm excited.
Yeah, that was actually the other layer to that game was that Penn played them really tough early, just kind of separated. Princeton separated as the game went on. Nick, I think I got a combined 14 hours of sleep over the last 3 days. I'm out of gas, man. I can't keep going. This was a great podcast. I really appreciate it. I do want to say once again, we miss Larkin. We wish that he was here to share his Bruno analysis with us. But the truth is, he just wants to watch the Masters. That's why he skipped the podcast.
And if you're tired, man, sitting and watching the Masters with your hands folded across your tummy, snoring while that music puts you to sleep, it's an all-time nap day. Thanks for gutting it out. And I had a lot of fun this episode. I feel like I say it almost every week now, but with things heating up in this season, the way that it's going, I'm like, this is just a wonderful time of year to be a sports fan. So enjoy it. Tune into those Friday slates, and we will see you next week.
Happy birthday, Nick.
Thanks. Love you, Terry.